Sharma Shenoy is in the process of establishing FICCI, India's foremost business body in the United States. At the time this podcast was recorded, a year ago, she was heading her own consultancy, Hummingbird Advisor. She has a unique ability to build engines of business growth through industry bodies. The Semiconductor Association of India and NASSCOM are where she honed her skills. Welcome to the My First Job podcast, where we find out what drives people, how luck plays a role, and the lessons they've learned. This is episode 8, and like every career journey, it's full of twists, turns, and insights. My name is Venugopal Nair. I'm the host of this podcast and CEO of Ideascape Communications, an advertising agency into branding, creative, and design. So settle in, sit back, and enjoy the conversation. Hi, Purnima, and welcome to the show.
Thank you, Venu. Such an honor to be here speaking with you.
It's my pleasure, my honor as well, Purnima. It's a wonderful thing to see how your career has gone from strength to strength. And right from the beginning, you were always very organized in what had to be done. I noticed most people, when they start off their companies, especially men, will talk about conquests and conquering the world. And you chose the hummingbird, which is among the smallest birds. And though you work in such a highly technical sector, the semiconductor space, what's the story behind hummingbird?
So the credit for the name hummingbird, as well as its logo, goes to my daughter, Nandita. She's okay. A millennial. I think the hummingbird stands for flexibility and adaptability, which is what one should be in business. I'm in the consulting space. I need to understand my customers, serve their needs, as long as we are on the right side of the law. So I think it's a very apt name.
Like I said, that's one of the places where you begin to see the difference between how women see things and how men see things. Even your start, that is, you took French tuition?
I love French as a language. I feel it's very similar to mathematics, especially the conjugation of verbs. And sometimes I really wonder whether I should have studied, my debate when I was in college is whether I should study French or political science. Okay. And then I went and did something totally different. Okay. But my love for the French language never goes. And I feel very thrilled, when I watch, let's say, French movies, Hercule Poirot, for example, and can understand the French even after so many years.
Right.
So when I was in college at Mount Carmel's, so I studied French for 7 years. If you want to make a little bit of pocket money, tuitions helped. So French tuitions were it. I didn't do it for too long, only in the final year. But let's say I had a good time doing it. I hope my students had as good a time as I did learning from me.
But you're saying you learned French only in college? You didn't have a link with the language earlier?
No, I did it from school. So I grew up in Goa, and where we had a choice of, we had English, we had Hindi, and we had a choice of either Marathi or French. And Marathi is something that one could learn in day-to-day life over there. And I was so fascinated by the French verbs and the conjugations that I took French all the way from standard 8 to second year of degree. So I studied it for 7 years. So, and then I went to the Alliance Française out here at Bangalore. I couldn't believe it, formally in school, we learn theory, how to write and read, but we never learn how to speak and to pronounce. And the audience did that for us. So, I have very happy memories of learning the language.
Okay. So then from tutor into your first job, which was with an advertising agency.
Yes.
How did that come about?
So when I was doing my MBA, I really liked marketing. I specialized in marketing, and advertising is what fascinated me. And more than that was advertising research. This was way before data science and analytics were even thought of as subjects. And I always felt the market, if we knew the data and if we could analyze it better, we would have more targeted messaging. So I started off in advertising research, and I had this wonderful boss called Arijit Ghosh. I think he's from IIT Kharagpur. But the most brilliant lateral thinker that I know to date. I've never met anybody like him. I think he was the first person who saw the potential for advertising research. This was before the internet era. So it was still from print publications. And that's where I started. Even today, I always go back to data. Data doesn't lie. So gut feel is good, and I like gut feel when I relating to people. But if you want to take a decision, nothing like that.
There is a bit of luck involved there, like you said. Coming across the one person or one of the few people in India who understood the importance of data in advertising, because as we've seen, advertising agencies have kind of split between digital and the traditional agency, because agencies, the traditional agencies never really managed data or they understood the shift. Whereas digital agency is focused on, the data, but they were not too close to a customer. At least that's the way I see it. But now, of course, that whole line is blurred and things are changed quite a bit. Do you remember or recall any specific things that you worked on in Sisters?
So at that time, HMT and Michael Bosch were the two largest accounts. And let me say, I was not too popular with the copywriters and the design folks who could not understand why you needed data. I mean, why was color so important? I mean, I felt color, a lot of things which we take for granted today with a lot of analysis. And at that time, it was all on gut feel. Gut is good, but to put big budgets and marketing budgets on gut feel. And, you have a very young rookie out of college trying to look at things differently. I'm sure they must have, and not as a person, but for what I was trying to say.
Okay. So then from advertising, you made another pivot. What is it that went through your mind when you decided that you needed to move to the next level?
I wanted more money and I wanted a better salary. I loved my boss. I loved my colleagues. I loved the environment. But the money was not good, okay? And I got my dream job in India's leading market research, and which had both qualitative and quantitative research, and which for me was absolutely what we needed if we had to build strong marketing campaigns. But I had a bad boss. And I have to be eternally grateful to her, because that made me an entrepreneur. I said, I cannot work under bad boss. You join a company ultimately and you leave a manager. So I'm very grateful to her for making my life so miserable that I decided to become an entrepreneur.
So between your first job and your second job, you went from a boss who was possibly one of the best you worked with to a boss who was possibly one of the worst you worked with.
I think if you have a great first boss, right, it spoils you for the rest of your life. Because you keep measuring. They might measure maybe 50%, 70%. But I was just so spoiled with my first job. And
okay. So then you decided that you couldn't stick around, though the job was fine, the boss wasn't. So then you decided to turn on. Yeah. Did you really think of it as being a risk at that point in time?
Venu, that's a very odd question. And I find people saying, risk, reverse risk averse. I've never been scared of taking, whether investing in the market or doing a job or doing anything. Maybe I should not boast, but I don't know what is fear.
Okay.
I mean, only if you ask me to jump into 8 feet of cold water in the pool, then that scares me. But the rest of it is about taking risks. So no, it doesn't scare me at all. It never scared me, and maybe I'm foolish, but taking risk is part of my DNA.
Sometimes I wonder if that is the way people are made. Risk averse, some people will take risks in areas that they might take physical risk, but not this one. Like you said, you're averse to physical, but this kind of risk, you didn't see it as being a risk at all. But what are the factors that you consider?
So the business that I started with a co-founder whom I got, I spoke to her and she liked what I was thinking about, is that I was looking for a job, and I realized there was no place in Bangalore. And, I was based in Bangalore. I was already married at a very young age. I didn't see myself moving out of there. And I said, if I'm looking for a job, what are the options? How do I get another job? Then I realized that there were no options in the market. All the options were in Bombay. And so I suddenly felt like someone in her 20s that here is a big opening in the market which one can take advantage of. And this was just as Infosys and Wipro were getting off the And Bangalore, and then I realized that advertising or market research and FMCG companies were not growing in Bangalore, but technology. So I was very lucky to have Wipro as my first customer and Infosys as my second.
Wow.
Okay.
You got the big, yeah.
Okay.
I mean, obviously, they were not as big as they were, as they are today, but it was still a major leap, right?
It was a great start, and I think they set such high standards for integrity and working that, you know, when you work with the best, you know, you don't compromise on the at all or on your principle. So I think they were great learning grounds to have such fabulous customers as number one. And so I think, you know, we started off at the right time by sheer accident. But in the first year, I think around that time, there was some Kuwait war and it affected us. Any entrepreneur, resilience, women especially, resilience is also part of our DNA. You don't give up. I think also people should know when to give up. But yeah, at that time, we didn't know about giving up. We just persevered. And we did that business for 10 years. Finally exited when a venture fund bought my partner and me out.
What kind of recruitments did you make?
So we focused increasingly, we did a lot of what you would call in parlance as headhunting assignments. Mm-hmm. It feels very good when you see some of those people, you know, were hired as VPs or as part of senior management, went on to become CEOs of those companies. It was never about bulk recruitment or these numbers. It was always quality over quantity.
Okay.
And we always made sure we had a premium pricing.
Okay.
So I never competed on price.
Did you have any previous experience in recruitment?
Nothing, zero.
Wow. You figured that you would be able to identify the right talent and deliver.
Yeah.
And figured out how to do it while you were doing it.
Everything is about selling, Venu. Whatever you do in life, whether you're running a company, everything is about selling. Two things we need to have in school and at college level: sales and how to read business reports. How to do business planning, balance sheets, profit and loss. If people are equipped with these three things right from school level, there's so much more we can do. And so I think women can do. Sales is a great word. People think, I don't want to be a salesperson. But I think sales is at the core of it. And if you can sell, you can do anything. And sell with content. I don't mean loose selling. I mean serious selling. Understand what you're selling and have faith in what you're selling. And it'll work out.
So how do you go about recruiting people? The requirements were fairly large. You would have
I'm
to
not
find...
giving you a, I'm not giving away any secret sauce, Venu.
Yeah, I know. That's where a lot of things are hidden. You've given part of it by saying, yes, you had to know how to sell well. I think that is really the point. A lot of people assume that second stage is where you have to think it through. How do you get these people? How do you locate them? How do you figure out which I think are the points where you excel? Which is why I think you built it over 10 years into what it became.
Yeah.
So then that I think was another gateway.
So after Nexus, which was my company's name, was acquired by E4E, the venture fund, I worked there for some amount of time. And then I took a break of about 6 months to understand what I wanted to do in life and what were my priorities. At that time, I was very intrigued by what industry bodies were doing. I thought they had a very pivotal role to play in shaping the economy, you know, representing a sector, you're representing industry out there. So I worked with NASSCOM for a while. Then I worked with the Manipal Group, heading their marketing and strategy, where I worked with two great guys. You know, I've been so fortunate in the people. One was Dr. Ranjan Pai, who now heads the group. And the other one was D.A. Prasanna, the person ex-GE and ex-Wipro head. I turned from a person who was focusing on inputs to being totally outcome-driven. So I'm very grateful to them because they saw obviously some potential in me, which I did not see in myself. The hours were long. There was a lot of travel, but the learning was tremendous.
So when you say industry body, you of course are the founding president of the Semiconductor Association. So was it something that you saw because of the interactions you were having, or you felt that given that India was a growing power in IT services, this would be one of the areas that needed to be focused on?
So actually the IAC, at that time it was the India Semiconductor Association. It went on to become the India Electronics Semiconductor. About 33 companies met together at the Leela in Bangalore and said we need to have a trade body of our own. You know, semiconductors are not IT services. So they decided to set up this trade body called ISA. And I think they spoke to 11 people globally. They wanted to hire a president to head it. And finally, they found this woman in the backyard. And, you know, I said, no, I don't like this title of president. It's too fancy. You know, give me a little more down-to-earth title.
Okay.
And anyway, they found me suitable. I wasn't even interviewing for the job. You know, when you have some great CEOs sitting across the table and saying, Pudma, we want to do this. And, you know, you are an entrepreneur at heart and see it as an entrepreneurial venture. So I started by like employee number one, registering that company, opening a bank account, working with some really nice, in a semiconductor industry, always say has the nicest human being.
Right.
Okay, wonderful human beings. And at that time, a lot of people tried to say, you are going against NASCOM. And I said, no, this is a David and Goliath battle. We're not doing a battle. Everything is about people, like I said. Semiconductor industry people cannot be hired by IT services. IT services people cannot be hired by semiconductor companies. So there lies the differentiation. It's not a competition. It's different spaces.
Yeah.
You know, it's like saying civil engineers and architects are the same. Semiconductor is the civil engineer and IT services are the architects. It's only in India that the architects came before the civil engineers. So,
I think I get an idea of how you're convincing people in high places as to how to simplify things. And were you often the only one of the few women in that when you started off?
Yeah, actually, I'm still used to being maybe one of two women, unless it's like Thai women, you know, which is a women's forum. Or aspire for her, whom I believe in and which I want to see growth, where I see a lot of women. But a lot of the places and a lot of the meetings till today, very rarely will I see a second woman. And if I see her there, she's usually a chartered accountant. And I'm very thrilled that so many young girls are turning to the CA exam and passing it. So in one of the groups that I work in, and one of the team members, she's a 23-year-old CA. I'm so impressed because she's going to have such a tremendous growth path.
Right. So I think these are two completely different challenges, right? The first thing is that you have to set up the foundation. When you're saying that you're setting up something for the India Semiconductor Association, like you said, you start off from the point where you open a bank account, then figure out, because in a lot of these cases, you have a policy, you have an objective, but each and every point has to be navigated.
Yeah.
And like you said, you won't be given a quarter by anyone else who thinks you're competition. So at times it is having to overcome the misconceptions that people have. And semiconductors are an expensive business, right? Setting up a facility can be very, very expensive.
I think we should differentiate between design and manufacturing.
Okay.
So India's intrinsic strength lies in design. Manufacture, you know, you don't need a dramatic policy change for the design industry. What could help is more up-to-date curriculum in the colleges. But design by itself will grow. And I always say, you know, India has its pockets in Bangalore, Noida, and Hyderabad, and up to an extent in Pune. These are our hubs. And, you know, when we speak of the numbers of chip designers in India, the world gets very excited. If I were to speak with these numbers to, let's say, folks who compare it with IT services, they don't get excited. Okay, because the numbers are so different. And I used to always say, one chip designer creates jobs for 10 embedded software engineers, who in turn create jobs for 100 software engineers.
Right.
So it is actually the chip designer is the seed from which the tree grows.
Right.
Okay, so we're very strong in design. And I think Bangalore, from the white, if I were to use a Bangalore example, the Whitefield, Sarjapur Road, HSR layout, is at the heart of the world's semiconductor chip design industry.
Wow. And why do you think this happened? Is it because TI set up, was it TI? I'm not, Texas Instruments started long ago. Is that one of the early influences? Why do you think India got good at chip?
See, one of the things that I'll come back to Bangalore's history. We have to see that the defense, so long ago, apparently there was a study, I don't know, this is hearsay, where they said if the missiles were to come from Pakistan, they would not reach Bangalore. This is some geographical study. So they set up the defense labs and the air, like HAL, DRDO. All of these labs were set up in Bangalore. So you had a very strong engineering community out here. And, you know, people who went to work and came back and were engineers and very true to their profession. Today, a lot of engineers also do other things. But at that time, they were doing hardcore engineering. So there was this culture in Bangalore. And then TI set up its center in 1987. And I think, you know, it's a fabulous company. And, you know, so many people have come from there, entrepreneurs in these spaces. So from there, you know, if one, let's say if the queen bee comes, the others will follow. But this, a lot of the following happened, I think, after 2006. And I remember In 2005, 2006, I continuously pitched to so many US design companies who wanted to know why they should come to India and where they should come. So I remember nonstop selling why India should be a destination for them. So I think ISA as a trade body has done extremely well in attracting investments and design companies to India.
I'm wondering if, you know, personally, whether your experience in recruitment and understanding what were the skill sets required for the companies that were growing shaped your understanding of where the market itself was going, or, you know, what exactly is happening? Or was this all that you had to literally ferret out from multiple interactions and research, all of these?
See, a lot of it is also swimming with the tide and swimming to save. I just take an example from ISA. So when I looked at it first, it was a deep tech sector which used to get buried on the tech pages of the Times and where nobody read it, okay? I mean, today Times has made the tech page very interesting by featuring technology leaders. But it wasn't so some years ago. So my first goal was I want to move semiconductors to the business pages of the Economic Times. More people, and you know, I gave myself 18 months to do it, and we did it in 11. When we released research reports on the sector, it used to come on the front page of the Hindu Business. So it suddenly became core. That's what the difference is. You know, it's not about being submerged and surviving, but, you know, getting your head and shoulders out of the water and exist very strong.
Yeah, and what I've seen here is that you just waded into the deepest of waters. Typically, I think a lot of women would be very conscious of their professional borders. I want a job that does this. But you never put any of those limits on yourself.
I never saw a career as a job, Venu. Okay. So you have to see, my mother was a mathematician. God bless her soul. And she worked in Southern Railway before I was born. My sister is a PhD in electronics, and I come from a family where there are so many teachers. We're never limited by gender. So gender, and we were never brought up that, you know, girls can't do something. So it doesn't even enter any part of my brain that women should have and can have limits.
Like you said, you saw what was required. You should get on to the business pages, that you come into the first thing, because you understood that those are the things which will actually make a difference as far as you went. So how did things move forward from there?
So at ISA, I think the first things we did was, public policy. We got 6 policy level out at the center and at the state level. Also got a lot of research report and data, and got something like nearly 200 companies to participate.
Okay.
And when I saw it was on such a good keel, you know, finally I'm an entrepreneur at heart. I wanted to get into the edtech. I thought there was tremendous capability for great content. And possibly that is the only, I wouldn't say it was misjudgment. Maybe I was too early. So after I left ISA to be an entrepreneur, I raised money too. But I made one mistake. I say I look at it for numbers, not for revenues and not for profitability. Okay. So even when I did my first business, Nexus, we earned very well in dollars too. And that keeps you afloat. The conversion is so good. But here I was working on the India market with Indian customers who do not pay their vendors in time. And the whole thing was getting messier and messier in working capital. And I used to have so many sleeps. So I've been there as an entrepreneur through a very good business and through a business where I could not sleep in the night because I was worried whether the bills are going to get paid. How many FDs am I going to break to pay salaries? Because as the leader of an organization, your first responsibility is to pay your employees on time. These are the people who have left what they're doing to have faith in you. And you know that. You've been there and you go through it. If you can't pay people, how will they have faith in you? And how will you have faith in yourself? I would say that was a really traumatic period of my time when customers who have raised money, who had money in the bank, tortured their vendors. So I was very happy when Latitude became a part of Moneypark Technologies. My team continues to work there. This was in 2017, 2018. And I'm very happy that, you know, the business they acquired, the people they acquired are still working.
Okay.
But I moved on because I cannot see myself fitting into a very large organization where I have to clock in at 9 o'clock and clock out. I think, Gautam Pai out there has a lot of vision and he's a great guy. And I'm very happy that, you know, my company come a part of company. But I was very relieved because the tension of paying monthly salaries, that was my biggest problem. And even today, when I work with entrepreneurs, I say, I know what you're going, I know what is going to kill you. And we start dealing with it from day one, not, you know, on the 29th day of the month.
Right. No, these are massive lessons. You know, getting into a business, you know, customers will come. They don't come.
No, it's not about customers. It's about customers paying you on time. It's not about getting business. It's about getting paid in time.
Yeah, that's I think another one of the attendant issues of all. But why do you think that happens? Is that peculiar to India? Because you have worked in, you have looked at other markets. Do you have any thing on why is it that we seem to, employers seem to be built that way? Or is that just a aberration?
I have not found it to be an exception for me or any other entrepreneurs. I think Indian businesses need to be kinder to the SMEs and pay them on time. You know, if you push an SME and don't pay them their monies on time, salaries of a lot of people suffer. Okay, and there's a limitation to how much the banks may talk. Today, I think Mr. Modi has done a tremendous difference by pushing for SMEs, but it was not some years ago. You went to the banks and they behaved horrendously. You had to give collateral, you had to give your FDs to get any kind of OD facility from them. And, so I think, you know, I have never found any overseas customer delaying on payment even once in my entire life. Okay. And this is nothing unique to me. You speak to anybody and they will not tell you anything different. And people who are in the B2B space. I mean, I have done hardly anything in the B2B.
No, it's like you said, it's one of those things where you're holding so many threads together and trying to move things forward that even if one thread slips or it gets cut somewhere in between, there are consequences that ripple right across the system. So it's a, I mean, first of all, getting into an area that is, like you said, not too many women in the field in the first place. Then understanding what needs to be done and then going to the source of the problem and then saying, okay, it needs to be tackled at that point. Okay, so set up the Semiconductor Association and then decided that you didn't want to be part of something. You like the largeness of the idea, but not the management of very large companies because they come with their own set of dynamics?
I don't have any problem with large companies at all, Venu. I just decided to go back and start my own company and be an entrepreneur again. I have absolutely no issue with large companies.
Okay.
They are the oxygen on which a lot of companies survive. I just think I started an edtech company a little too early. There's a matter of timing. When I started Nexus, the timing was right. When I started Latitude, the timing was wrong. So, and I exited in 2017, 2018. But in 2020, when COVID struck, the amount of people who called me up, said, Purnima, are you still running Latitude? You know, we want to buy it out. We want to work with you. I said, guys, you all are 3 years too late. Okay. But I was glad I exited at an honorable exit. I did not let anybody who had worked with me suffer. Everybody got their money. It was a very amicable move. So my conscience is clear. I feel happy. I would have been happier if I had made money from it, but at least I did not have losses from it.
Right. Sometimes those are the best points of whatever that you have done. When you said Latitude was a little early, was it in terms of the market or your setting up? Was it a question of timing?
I think it was a matter of timing. If I had started off 2 years later, it would have been great. But what happens is when you start a little too early and like I say, you're planting seeds in a dry field, there's no water for it. And, you know, but 2 years go by and then you start getting impatient and start getting a little weary rather than starting 2 years later when the timing is right and then everything works out well. So I think the timing is a great part of luck. So right. I've seen it earlier. Luck works. Of course, luck works. But bad luck also works. It pushes you in the wrong direction.
What is Latitude's main focus?
So we were creating content, educational content. For example, we did one of the alliances that we had was with IEEE. Okay, so we create content for online learning. Online learning is like so easily accepted today. But in 2011, people were still struggling with this concept of online learning.
Yes.
So it's a matter of timing.
So 2011 was too early, but by 20, it had matured into something which was red hot.
Absolutely different.
What made you think at that point that this is the way it's going to go?
I did not have too much of data. But I felt that people would be wanting, you know, there were so many, especially in urban areas, there were so many people who are going to work and who wanted to improve themselves. Bangalore teaches you many things. If I'm staying at one end of Bangalore and there's a great class going on the other end, you cannot travel. The traffic is so horrendous that, you know, your life is limited to a particular geography. And I felt at that point of time that people are going to start learning online. And why will I go and learn online only if I'm going to get some great teaching and content material? Okay, so like I said, I'm not a B2C player. So I do not know how to go and sell to consumers. But I know how to get customers who can deliver to these consumers.
Right.
Government did so many flip-flops. First, they said the universities can do online. They can't do. They can do. It went back and forth so much. And when you are someone who is supplying that content, you're also feeling the flip-flop.
Right.
But today, it's like accepted. Universities can deliver content online. But
yeah,
I just thought, you know, that they are going to do it. And I thought they would do it much faster than the pace at which they were.
But generating content was never a problem.
This is a wonderful city. Bangalore is a fantastic city with great people. Okay, there is nothing in terms of knowledge that you cannot get from the people. There's every kind of skill. So if I want to do in a particular area, you have great content.
But when some of these things start out, there are only a few people who really understand where it's going. In terms of online learning, do you think that it will ever prove to be any kind of competition to colleges and schools? The two are kind of parallel tracks, or it's more of filling some of the gaps rather than understanding them.
See, I think, you know, students need to be in college to learn social skills. You need peers, you need friends, you need that warmth, you need society. That cannot be replaced at all. And we have all seen that how burnt out we got out with Zoom in 2021. And students also were very, very weary with it. But I think a lot of, you know, labs, for example, cannot be replaced. Something physical which has to be done. Okay, it's some things like design. People do work projects in groups. That cannot be replaced. But so much of learning. For example, I did, you know, there's an exam to be an independent director on the board. I did that exam 100%. I studied for that exam 100% online content. You know, it was all there. I had the time because I was not commuting and I was not traveling. So those things can be done. I don't need company to do that kind of learning. But if I had a project, I would have been happier sitting with three people across the table. And
yeah.
Everything has its pluses and minuses, but nothing can replace human interaction.
Yeah. But how do you manage all that? You run your company and then you're on the boards of several companies now. How did that come to be?
So serendipity. I have no words for this. So I was first on the board of a public limited semiconductor. Alongside that, I'm right now on the board of two companies whose managements are very solid. One is Dixon Electronics. And the other one is the NSE IT, which is a subsidiary of the National Stock Exchange. Great management, since then a lot of transparency, a lot of corporate governance. And the other independent, other directors on the board are people whom I also learned from. And there's a lot of mutual respect. So, you know, every year I get about 4 requests to be on the boards of companies. I am lucky. I have friends whom I can sound off and say, should I go ahead or not go ahead? So it's okay. Not about being on a board and being on committees. Like I sit on a nomination and remuneration committee. I sit on the audit committee. This requires a lot of reading and knowledge, and you have to be so neutral but have an impact. It takes a lot of time. So I admire people who sit on 5, 6, 7 boards. And I say, wow, you guys, I don't know how you do it. But, you know, 2 boards is a lot of work that goes
on. Okay. So the exam that you did, which you qualified, you said the online, what exactly do you, is it a process of how do you manage governance, or how is it that you provide inputs? What does that course cover?
This is from the Ministry of Corporate Affairs under the Ministry of Finance, Government of India. The Government of India has mandated that independent directors should have qualified, should have passed this exam. I was already sitting on boards and somebody just told me, you know, you have time now due to COVID. Because, you know, you're not traveling, you're not going anywhere. And suddenly you have 3 hours easily at your disposal all day. So the content is great. I'm not saying it's delivered superbly, but it's online content. It teaches you so much. You know, these are laws, corporate laws, finance, all of it that you need to understand. What are related party transactions? What is right? What is wrong? I think the course is really good learning. You know, I could apply so much of it after I did this exam in the May. I think it is great. And anyone, even if you don't, if you want to run your own company sometime, if you know this, it really helps you keep good governance.
And from this, to continue, so Hummingbird Advisors is looking at semiconductor design opportunities. What exactly is the role that Hummingbird does?
So we are a consulting firm. There are a couple of things that we work I work on basically three projects at a time, and I put up teams by project. So, for example, I can speak about some of the things that I can speak about. For example, CDOT has just decided to support innovation and startups in the telecoms.
Okay.
So the whole policy document for that was put together by us.
Okay.
And CDOT is a great organization with stellar people within. So we got good inputs and good sounding boards, and it took us 3 months, but we have a very comprehensive policy, all documents, so they can just go ahead and implement. Okay. I'm just sharing some of the work. Right now, we are helping a company in southern India which wants to get into this industry. So I have a great team with one of the best leaders in the electronics manufacturing space, a great finance guy, a great strategy person and myself, and we're putting the whole recommendation together for them. Just handle the acquisition of an Indian design company by a US public limited semiconductor. So these are some of the assignments, and they're all in a deep tech related space. You can say they're all first cousins to each other, but nice. But it is fascinating. And since I'm not about quantity and it's always about quality, I spend a lot of time thinking about it, relating to my customers. Besides that, I support three startups. One of them, which is very dear to my heart, is Aspire for Her, set up by my friend Madhura Dasgupta Sinha. She and I were chivening scholars to the UK many years ago, and our friendship.
How did that come about? How did you become a Chevening Scholar?
So a British Chevening Scholarship is there are lots of kinds of scholarship. This was for women in leadership and management. Okay. This was a mid-career thing for me. It really, 12 of us were selected from here, which is about 12 out of 500 applications.
Wow.
Okay, we had some 4 or 5 rounds of selection. Spent 3 months in the UK, really good learning. We had a project, we did it here, we did it there. There's a lot of bonding, and 6 of us are very close even today, so many years later. But it actually gave me a great direction. I should give a lot of credit to the Chevening Scholarship, because it set me, your one's mind is a little clouded on how do I proceed. And then you see women who are your peers, who are in different spaces. How are they proceeding with their lives? And then suddenly you see no obstacles at all. So I give a lot of credit, because it just removed, if I had any reservations or barriers in my mind.
Okay.
So Madhura set up Aspire for Her. I've been there from day one supporting her, because I think what she's doing is going to be so much economic importance. It is not social cause. It is an economic cause. I also work with Uniqueen, which is set up by this amazing young entrepreneur called Roshni Mohandas. She's worked with Infi and with IKEA. And it's an enterprise SaaS company for product pricing in e-commerce, again in the B2B space. And third one is a processor company out of Indian Institute of Science called Morphing Machine. So I'm deeply involved with these three companies, Hummingbird and the board position. I do nothing else. I cannot take on any more assignments, and I'm very long-term with these.
And yet you managed to write a book and bring up a fine young lady. So...
Yeah, I also get a great marriage going. You remember this. I've been very happily married for many years.
Yes, so that's the thing. How did the book come about?
Okay, so I wanted to write a book since I was 14 years old. Credit for the book should actually go to COVID. Okay, because like I said, the two things that happened during COVID is I passed this exam, and the other thing is I wrote a book.
Wow.
Okay, I mean, you get so much of time suddenly, right? You're traveling nowhere. You are not commuting. You're doing everything from one physical location. My co-author, Supriya Panchangam, is an amazing young person. And I think she'll go far. I like her thinking. I like the way she puts things together. We wrote this book in 3 months. But it took us another to get it published, editing, all of it. It was released at T-Hub last year on Women's Day as part of their Women's Day celebrations. And T-Hub CEO MSR M. Srinivas Rao was very supportive, and he released it. It went to number 6 on Amazon's business books. And I think that gave me great thrills.
How would you describe the book? Is it covering things that women would have specific things as entrepreneurs? Or is it a kind of reference guide? How exactly would
you classify it? So the book is called Accelerating Her Business. Right. And it's more like a guidebook on how to help you accelerate women's businesses. So you could be an accelerator, you could be a corporate, you could be a university. How can you help women who are entrepreneurs? Because the needs of women and the way market treats women as a, who are entrepreneurs is very different. So how do you help these businesses to grow and make this program successful? So I would say it's a guidebook. It's a good guidebook. I would say a very good guidebook.
How do you see that difference? Are there a couple of things that you can say about how businesses or accelerators see women entrepreneurs? What are the differences?
I think women need to have more confidence in themselves. I keep saying this. Most women, and I find even as entrepreneurs, they always begin with an apology. Okay. Women are most apologetic about what they do. A lot of women. And I say that is not necessary. Everybody has the same flaws. They're just different degrees. But how to raise money? Okay, a lot of women, I find them saying, I don't know how to raise money. I don't know how to manage money. And they will give it to a husband or brother whose knowledge is same or less. So, and this is not, I mean, I'm so surprised by this, but small businesses. So, you know, if women were to learn, selling and how to manage their money and how to have more confidence in themselves, they're already doing well. They can go so much more further. I really believe in it.
No, and I think it's very clearly by focusing it, accelerating her business rather than saying accelerating a business.
Yes.
You made it very clearly about saying that women need a different kind of approach and given the current social situation, everything. So how has it been bringing up a young lady as a parent? What has been your experience?
I think today's kids are so smart. My daughter is a millennial and I'm learning from her. Her maturity in her 20s, I wish I had it. Okay, amazing. Today's generation is so smart. Okay, and I'm like, you know, blown by the way they analyze situations. They understand, you know, where, how hard to work. They work incredibly hard. They use social, for example, you know, so many social. But knowing what is a full stop, what is a comma, how do you balance your personal life and your work life? You know, at one time, I think in my 20s and even in my 30s, everything was a comma. There were no full stops. Okay, one merged into the other. But today, I think very, very smart. They work so hard, but they know also how to have, you know, balanced life. So I think, you know, I'm very lucky to have a daughter. She's my great sounding board. And I mean, like I said, that's what I said. And she works as, she's an interaction designer. She works at Mindtree. So I'm very happy about where she is.
And that is so fulfilling because I think you're saying, yes, I'm not taking anything away from kids today who are very smart. But looking back at what you have done, when you started to where women are seen today, like you said, you were probably the only woman in the room and it was having to go up against men who traditionally believed that they should be, you know, managing things, whether it was at home or at the office. So, yes, your background prepared you, your family background prepared you for never seeing those limits. But I think it's a different kind of strength to be able to take on an established norm and then say that, no, but I will see, I will make the changes, because getting people to accept these changes is, I think, 60% of the problem.
I don't know, Venu. I mean, all my mentors have been amazing men, you know, all of them, 100%. Men who have had faith and never treated me with any concession because I was a woman, neither did they be software targets. Neither did I need to have shoulders to cry on. I think amazing mentors, like 100% men, great women as friends, because you need friends and family. So great, you know, even men being friends and mentors have played an important part in that. My husband has been amazingly supportive. So, I mean, I should not take away from that. At home, when you get support, you know, then you realize there are no blocks. So, yes, I wish that credit should be there. Also, you know, I think in places like Bombay, where banking and FMCG has a lot of women, there'll be far more women in the room. But being here in, let's say, a hard deep tech space, the number of women earlier were lesser. But I'm happy, hopefully there will be more and not the lesser women. The pressure is really at the middle management. No, mentoring is one part. The second part is how do you balance your family and your work life, which is a problem. There's nothing called balancing. It's how do you manage? There's no balance. Men also, women also. There is no balance. Just how do you manage it is the...
Right. Are you seeing a difference from the time that you got in versus today? are you seeing based on, since you're working on Aspire for Her, what kind of changes are you seeing in the women you interact with today?
I think today's girls are fabulous. Like I said, they do not see any limits for themselves. It is, you know, because I'm a girl, I can't do it, or will I be able to do it, is never a question for them. I think India's future is in great hands when I see the girls today. It's not that the boys are not great, but since you're asking me about girls, I'm so impressed.
Yeah, because I'm saying that's the other part. You have a special interest in them, and your work is also does involve. So the three startups which you have involved with, are they all helmed by women?
It's very surprising. Okay, this is by sheer coincidence that the co-founders or founders of all three startups is a woman.
Okay. No, that's a great place to be in also, because I think as you see a company slowly grow, having to contend, like you said, difficult aspects of growing a business, either it's the environment or the policy is not right or something else is not okay. The biggest thing about a woman is the resilience that she has got both within the family and outside. So what is it that you would like to tell young women who lack the confidence or who are unsure of themselves?
Just hang in there. This too shall pass.
Yes, as simple as that. I think it's been a wonderful experience talking to you from the time you started. One of the things you said was that you were always very clear about what you wanted to achieve. Where do you think that came from? Because a lot of people are not. Is it that you simply have an ability to analyze things and then act in a way that ensures that you know exactly what needs to happen?
No, it also comes from knowing what you don't want to do. So it eliminates, let's say, a lot of things off the table. There are things that I will not compromise and which I don't want to do. So it makes life easy. It just removes, you know, the chaff from the wheat. So then it becomes easier as you go along.
So instead of saying, what do I want to do? Be very clear about what you don't want to do, and the options will present themselves. You know exactly.
In a way
that becomes the same. So it's been wonderful talking to you, Purnima. Thank you for sparing the time. And I think you've taken us on a journey which is quite rare, because let's face it, at the point when you got in and then you worked your way up into being the president of the Semiconductor Association, like you said, it required a lot of anticipation, analysis and action, all of which you displayed in equal measure. So whether it was seeing how the future of content would play out and how online, and I think you gave a very clear example of where online works and where online doesn't, to everything that you're doing for women today and how you see the focus and writing a book. As usual, I'm always amazed at what women are able to achieve, because men have everything spread out on a plate in front of them and they'll still say that, you know, I don't have enough. But women stepping back are able to do so much more.
Thank you, Venu. You have been such a fascinating interviewer. I don't know whether I spoke too much, but you certainly got me to speak.
I'm glad you did that, because the thing in all of these conversations is I want to understand the mind of the person. What were the decisions and why you made some of those? It's very easy to get a listing and a point by point. But if you stop to examine what happened, then I think the conversation goes in fascinating directions. Thank you. It's been a pleasure interviewing you. And thank you for coming on.
Thanks a million. Thank you, Venu. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye.
My First Job, the podcast, is a production from Ideascape Communications. Guest relations, promotions, and creative is managed by Deepa Ravi, with occasional support by Venugopal Nair. Archiving and technical help is provided by LPS Jayachandran.